Father's Day is almost as old as Mother's Day. It was founded really about 1909, and not with the same nobility of radical purpose that Mother's Day was founded. Mother's Day actually started out as a political act. It was to recognize what was not recognized, what was not appreciated, and that was the real important work that women did, both as mothers and as wives in the house with the kids, in all those ways that were unappreciated and discounted, even demeaned. Father's Day was a makeup to the dads, which was recognition to the already recognized and powerful, and kind of power to the powerful, which is the way society often works. But they met a common fate in being commercialized, so that they become today about flowers and cards and telephone calls and ties and barbecues. And those are all fine things, because they are ways of doing what's really important, and that is having time together, time to share, time to learn from each other and be with each other. Fatherhood, I think, is still not recognized in our society. It is still not realistically portrayed. When I was growing up and looked to television for wisdom, which was, of course, a mistake in the first place, I would see fathers portrayed as all-wise but distant characters who gave oracular pronouncements. Mom would come confused with the problem of what to do, and father, knowing best, would give an answer. Or, on the other hand, the fathers were doofuses, or doofi for the literati. They were doofi who just were buffoons and clowns and were completely incompetent and had nothing but false bluster and false certainty. Ozzie Nelson was not my role model, although the idea of wearing a sweater and a tie around the house and never going to work did have a certain appeal to it. But he wasn't my role model, and thank God neither was Ozzy Osbourne. It wasn't until Bill Cosby that there was a recognizable father figure on television. A father who was not all wise and all knowing, a father who got mad but who listened, who was involved, who spent time, who worried, who did all of the things that parents do. Now, to too much of history, fatherhood has been seen as a physical act, as a father as a sperm donor, and not having an ongoing connection with the fruits of his partner's labor and his pleasure. And that's a very distorted view that cheated women, it cheated children, and it cheated men out of the opportunity of getting together and learning how more fully to love and to be with someone and to give them the gift of presence in their lives. I know that when I became a father, I knew nothing. I had read the books. I had gone, being a child of the 60s, well, a child of the 50s, but fatherhood in the 60s. I had gone to Lamaze classes. I was ready to count backwards through all the different phases of birth. But then after the birth, I just assumed, hey, I'm just going to know what to do. It's instinctual. It's just built into the human condition. Well, love may be instant. Even bonding may be instant. The knowledge that you are connected to this little person is instant. But that's really different from knowing what to do, from knowing when to hold them and when to fold them and when to walk away and when to run, knowing when to say no and knowing when to say no, and knowing when to say yes and when to say I love you and when to say I love you anyway. All of those things were just not in the books, and I'd read the books. I did my due diligence, and the same way, and it prepared me just as well as cross-cultural studies at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, prepared me for living in North Africa, which is to say, not at all, because there was this little human being, your cousin Adam, and he was introduced to the world upside down and backwards, which probably sunny side up, which probably explains why he went to Santa Cruz and it was a successful match. But I didn't know what to do. I had to pay lots of attention. I thought of myself as somebody who was evolved, who got past all of those old stereotypes of the distant father. I stayed home. I had work as both in grad school and ministry school, and in eventually with my first congregation, Star King, where I could be home days, and I could change the diapers and cook the food, and I became a carpool daddy eventually, and I did cooking, and Adam, when he was very young, said, when I grow up, I want to cook like my daddy, and we felt that we had shattered the stereotypes. We had shattered all the images, and Berkeley had won. Well, I was as deluded about myself then as I was before his birth. Our aspirations were great. We did want to shatter the stereotypes. We didn't want to be distant dads. We wanted to be involved, but that first and a half generation of trying to figure out how to do it was really difficult. And it was stumbling, and it was stumbling with roles between men and women and how you did this and how you divided the housework. And there were some moments of great epiphanies that I had. I think I can tell this one. When Adam was first born, first pastoral call I made with my then wife, Barbara, and we went and we took the baby, and we went to the congregant's home and put the baby in a room, and we socialized and had a nice time. And I went in to check the baby, and I went back out, and I said, the baby's... And she just looked at me and said, yeah. And because of your chromosomes and mine, you think I like having my fingers in the diaper? Ah, epiphany. Just remember, no ruling class ever gives up its privilege without a challenge, without being called on our nonsense. And that was a transformative event for me. Should have been perfectly obvious. It wasn't because, well, duh, I'm a guy. It was a learning experience. The tragedy of the human condition is that by the time we figure it out, they're out. The time we figure it out and we know when to hold them and when to fold them and how much noise to tolerate and when to say yes and when to say no, we're grandparents and we have all of this experience and all of this wisdom. And then we go to the kids and we say, well, don't you let them play, let them make noise, let them throw the ball in the house. And our kids look at us like, where were you when we needed you to be like this? And there's this kind of bitter resentment that goes on. And so we had our three of our grandsons were over and spent the night last night. I won't say they slept. I'll say they spent the night. And the rules are really different when you're a grandparent, and it's terrific. And we're trying to run our children's lives by how we treat our grandchildren. But it really is, you know, they say that youth is wasted on the young. Parenting, in a sense, is wasted on the young. We should all do it in our 50s and 60s, except we wouldn't have the energy to get up in the morning. But it's about learning and paying attention to another human being. Our aspirations were great, and we didn't succeed. I mean, we didn't succeed in fulfilling them. There, I went to choral recitals. I went to T-ball games. I went to the anarchy, that is A-S-Y-S, you know, soccer, where they all kick each other in the shins until the parents cry. I did all that stuff, but I was also way too absent, way too often. I see in the coming generation more wisdom, more ability of the men to understand. It isn't something that we do simply to relieve our wives or partners. It is something that we do because it is good for our hearts and souls. It is good for our children. It is good as a role model because, indeed, that first cliche of education is true. Children learn what they live, and they are watching, and they know what we value. When I look at the legacy that my father left for me, it was a legacy of time. It wasn't a legacy of money. It wasn't a legacy of things. Until I started thinking about this, I never counted the cars that were either given or passed down to me as anything, and I still don't. What counts is going to the first Dodger game in the Coliseum. What counts is going to the first Dodger game in Dodger Stadium when it opened. And I was not a particular baseball fan, but it was the honor of spending time. It was going to the Hollywood Park because my father liked the ponies. And it was my father taking me to Indianapolis because I liked the cars. It was a mutual exchange, sometimes not about what I was interested in, but I gave my time as a gift, or what he was interested in, he gave his time as a gift. And that's the precious part. That's the precious part of what we give each other. My father was not perfect. He had a temper. He spanked me twice. Once was funny. He said, "This is going to hurt you more than it hurts me." And it happened to have a Boy Scout knife in my pocket. And he gave me one of those. And he said, "I thought that's just a cliche. That actually seems to have hurt me more than it hurt you." And the other time was I had interrupted him for about the fifth time while he was filling out his tax form, and it was April 14th. This taught me two valuable lessons. One, don't interrupt people when they're filling out their tax forms. Two, get an accountant and don't fill out your tax form. The other is that my father did suffer from some depression, and it was a gift. It taught me how to care for a person. It taught me that love was a two-way street. It was time that he gave me when I was not well, and it was time that I gave him. And it taught me to the soul and to the bone about what we can mean to each other. I couldn't fix him. I couldn't end his depression, but I could be there with him and keep him company all through the night, as he, as well as my mother, kept me company all through the night. My father, other legacy was, the other thing he took me to. He took me to Mort Saul in 1959. Changed my life. Changed my life. And for those of you who don't know who Mort Saul is, he's a political satirist and comedian with whom I have some ongoing relationship. When we see each other, he always says the same joke because he doesn't remember. But he says, "I'm a comedian who's accused of being a preacher. You're a preacher who's accused of being a comedian." We giggle, we laugh, have coffee, and then go away. But there's some truth to it. What we have, and it was the core of last week's sermon, is time. What we have is time to learn, time to break stereotypes and archetypes and expectations and open up our hearts to each other in a deep way. We have a society that pulls us in two directions as fathers. We have part of society that still sees the father as a sperm donor, that still sees the father, or the father may see himself, as simply someone who is leaving biological graffiti in the form of children and not having a relationship with those children. But we also see amazing changes in parenting by young men who are connected, who don't do it because it's a political act. They do it because it's a right act. They do it because they understand that being connected in love to one another, to parents, to spouses, to children, to grandchildren, is how we connect in life. This flash of consciousness that is light can be a lonely and isolated spark unless we link it up through time to previous generations, through ourselves, and on to new generations. That's the challenge, not simply of fatherhood, it's also of motherhood, of parenting, of step-parenting. It is having the radical courage to open up our hearts to the wonder and vulnerability of love, of taking our children into the embrace of more than arms, but arms are important, of more than words, but words are important, but living through how we live and model our lives, our values, because that's how they will be transmitted. Our children will see what we do. And so what we do, again, becomes very important, not simply for ourselves, not simply for our own pleasure or development, although that too, but most importantly, for the next generation. This is how we, from generation to generation, hand off a legacy that is lived. We show our love by how we give our love with our open hearts.